Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Let's talk.
John Brown.
Peacemaker. You thanked the United Nations and the untold story of the 1960s is being described as a wonderful subject, beautifully written, evoking a world startlingly like and unlike our own story. It is written by Thant Mint Yu, and I'm delighted to say that Thant joins me live on the line now. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. Now, explain a little bit, because this is a book about your grandfather, I believe.
Yes, that's right. So U Thant was my mother's father. I grew up with him. I was born when he was the head of the UN in the 1960s and lived with him until he died when I was about 8 years old. And I worked for the UN myself for a few years in the 1990s and 2000s. But I never really thought very much about his time at the head of the UN until I began researching this book a few years ago.
I caught a quick front cover that you posted on your feeds. The Daily Mail described him as a gin-swilling Buddhist. So this is an interesting take on the head of the United Nations. Give me a little bit of your grandfather's history that doesn't involve sort of spirits.
Well, it's a really remarkable story in a way, because he was born in Burma, which is then part of the British Empire. It was actually part of British India when he was born. And he lived in this very remote town, about a day's steamer ship ride from Rangoon, which was the capital of Burma at the time. And he was a school teacher and then headmaster at this little school in this little town until he was almost 40 years old, never left except for a couple of years at university. And at age 39, he decided on a mid-career or mid-life career change. And within 10 years, found himself as Burma's ambassador to the UN, living in Midtown Manhattan in New York. And within a few years of that, became the only human being in the world acceptable to both John F. Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev to be the Secretary General.
Must have been fascinating. I mean, how do you go from being sort of as a school teacher in rural Burma to actually getting into the United Nations? I mean,
It was in some ways it was part of a bigger story, because all these countries were becoming, many of these countries in Asia and Africa were becoming independent at the time, and they joined the UN, which was the thing to do, and it was the way to try to guarantee their independence. And he joined government service, rose up through the ranks, traveled the world with the prime minister, and was seen as a good person, a good diplomat, or a good potential diplomat. And when he was at the UN over just those few years in the late 1950s, he became known as the person who got along with everyone, both East and West, colonial world, ex-colonial world. And he was seen as a good negotiator, a person who could reconcile different opinions, but also push ahead on this new agenda that was coming to the UN of decolonization as well.
Because the really important point, isn't it? Because it is this decolonization experience that you have both in Africa with all the former colonies, the French trying to hang on for as long as possible for all their colonies, but the British know that the days of empire are numbered, and so therefore you have these. I use the word especially with somewhere like the former Burma as these new countries, because obviously they're millennium old, and there is a hope, there is a trying to find a place in the world. And it's very easy to sort of overlook the importance of these countries in the whole if you like, the geopolitics of the 60s, because people just think, oh, well, if you're talking about what we used to refer to as Southeast Asia, people just then tend to look at them as sort of dominoes. So Indochina, which then becomes Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos are formed, and obviously Burma or Myanmar as well.
I mean, in the 1950s and 60s, they created the world that we have today. And we often talk today about, you know, collapse of the liberal order and everything else. But actually, it's an order that was set up in the 50s and 60s at the UN by these countries. So, you know, in the West, sitting here in the UK, we often think of the history of the 20th century as World War One, and then World War Two, and then the Cold War, and then post-Cold War. But for most people in the world, the history of the world is the history of empire and post-empire. And when the UN was set up in 1945, it was just meant to be this wartime alliance that would continue to police the world, the US, the Russians, everyone, you know, the British as well. And it was these countries that fought for their independence, won their independence, hacked their way into the UN, Franklin Roosevelt's project, made it their own, transformed it, and created the international system that we've had ever since. So it's a huge part of the story that we have, you know, our story, our collective story, that we often overlook.
And of course, this is all taking place, it's post breakup of empires, but all, and it's obviously post Second World War, but also we go headlong into the Cold War. And you have, obviously, you know, by the early 50s, you've got the situation in Korea, and then there's the sort of, when Eisenhower, you know, Eisenhower leaves power in 1960 and, you know, Kennedy takes over, the Soviet Union flexes its muscles with Cuba. It is a, should we call it a quote-unquote interesting time to be involved at the helm of the UN?
Yeah, the UN, when he took over in 1961, the UN was in its deepest crisis. It was, as you say, you know, it's the coldest time of the Cold War. So US and Soviet tanks were facing off against each other in Berlin. There were potential hotspots all over the world. The British and the Americans and the Russians were barely speaking to each other. And the last UN Secretary General, Dag Hammarskjöld, had just been killed in a mysterious plane crash. The UN was broke. The French and the Russians were refusing to speak to him before he died. And the UN had this massive peacekeeping operation in the Congo, which was exploding as well. So he takes over, you know, 12 years, 13 years from being a school teacher in rural Burma. And he soon faces this enormous test. I mean, first it's the Congo deciding what to do next. And then within a few months, it's the Cuban Missile Crisis as well.
The general feelings, as you said, he's a man who could get on with everybody. I mean, you can't, can you develop that skill? Or was he just sort of an affable fellow, hail fellow, well met sort of character?
Yeah, I guess he was an extrovert. And one story I learned in researching this book is that, you know, when he was a school teacher, when he was, you know, lived in this little wooden town, dirt roads, no electricity, every evening after an early dinner, he would go off for a walk stroll with my grandmother. But they never got past the third or fourth house because he wanted to stay and chat with everyone. And, you know, when he went to Rangoon, he made lots of friends. When he left Rangoon to go to New York, to fly to New York, over 300 people went to the airport to see him off, you know, all his friends. And so, I mean, he was good at making friends. He liked being around people. So I think that was one of his skills. And also he was someone who grew up in different cultures. Even though he was in this little town in Burma, he read English books. His father had, you know, he inherited from his father this small library of Victorian, Edwardian books. And so he grew up in kind of different worlds, different cultures. And I think that was also a skill that he brought to the UN as well.
Yeah, the thing, I mean, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I normally am, fans, but one of the things that just struck me is the fact that, you know, he is probably the first non-European to lead the UN. And you have, yeah, you know, and you, you know, like it or lump it, you know, the 50s and the 60s are a very different place to not be of European descent, shall we say. And you mentioned the Congo. Well, if you know, that was formerly the Belgian Congo. Leopold, shocking, you know, shocking abuses going on. And there is still, you know, there is still not even a covert, I mean, there's overt racism in several places. So as somebody from a non-European background, was he sort of hitting his head against the brick wall sometimes with that? Or did he have to use his skills to get by that bar?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, if you think of high diplomacy in the early 20th century through the 1950s, you basically think of, you know, what your people of European descent, Americans of European descent, Ivy League educated Americans or people from the continent who were, you know, in suits and or morning coats and top hats and everything else. And he was the first person of color, you know, in high diplomacy in that top office to lead an international organization. And around him were also this amazing group of people like Ralph Bunche, who won a Nobel Prize. He was an American, but he was an African American. He was a civil rights activist. He had an Indian advisor. He had an Egyptian advisor. So it was all something new, and it was very much a sign of the times. But as you suggest, I mean, the Congo was an enormous test because it was one. It was a country that had been ravaged by the Belgians. They granted the country independence. But then, you know, within days, they were intervening back in the country. And so for a lot of these newly independent countries, this was their nightmare scenario, that they would be given sort of nominal independence, but these ex-colonial powers would just continue to kind of dominate their economies and interfere as they wished.
So, and also the other one that people will always go on about is early 60s. Well, there's two major things, Cuban Missile Crisis, and obviously the Berlin Wall goes up. You know, I mean, as the saying goes, I want to be head of the UN. Well, be careful what you wish for, because not only do you have sort of white racist mercenaries running around the Congo, but then you have, and it's very easy to look back at the 60s and go, oh, that was a golden time, as we always tend to do, JFK, Camelot, the whole thing. But, you know, I've read reports of people who said, you know, in Manhattan, they went out and they mixed cocktails and they watched the skyline for the start of a nuclear war.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And, you know, the thing is that if you read almost anything about the Cuban Missile Crisis, even things written quite recently or watch a film about the Cuban Missile Crisis, you will never see a Burmese guy with his Indian and African deputies mediating in between the Americans and the Soviets. But that's exactly what happened. And it's an amazing episode in Cold War history of when, you know, the two superpowers were facing off. The Russians had missiles in Cuba. The Americans had established a blockade. The Soviet Navy was still streaming towards the Caribbean. And it looked like we were on the brink of nuclear Armageddon. And it wasn't just that the Americans were tough and the Russians backed down. In between, they had these mediators. And my grandfather inserted himself into the conflict. He sent both public and secret messages to both. And without giving away the whole story, which is in the book, I mean, he basically gave both sides, or crafted a way for both sides, Kennedy and Khrushchev, to have the time and the space for the diplomacy they both needed to kind of pull back from the brink. And then he went down to Havana and basically made sure that Castro was also not going to be a big problem in the settlement of this conflict.
And perhaps better than anybody else, because he's probably sort of overlooked you know, classrooms of unruly school children, but he realizes how important it is for all these people not to lose face and to everybody to have come out with a diplomatic outcome so there are no losers. So I know people say, well, Khrushchev blinked first, etc., but it's more nuanced than that, isn't it, Thant?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because I thought about this a lot, and I wasn't quite sure when I first researched this book why he was not remembered in this way. And the book, in some ways, I mean, the subtext is this exploration of this question of who, you know, what kind of people do we remember in history, and why do we forget certain types of people as well? I mean, if you look back at the New York Times for those days around the Cuban Missile Crisis, he was there on the front page every single day, so people knew it. It was subsequently over the years, but especially over the decades, that he's been kind of airbrushed out of history. And a lot of it is, you know, what you were just talking about before, that he was a person of color. He was from the outside. Maybe he was easy subsequently to overlook in different ways. But a lot of it is also because, even though he was in really good standing with the Americans after the Cuban Missile Crisis, worked closely with them in many ways, the Vietnam War got in the way. And that was his big test of whether or not to challenge the biggest superpower in the world, which had helped put him in place, over this war that he was incredibly frustrated over and wanted to stop.
And that, again, I talk about the nuances in diplomacy in there. I mean, the you know, if the French hadn't learned anything from, you know, Bien Den Phu, and then the Americans getting involved covertly, and people seem to forget that, you know, Ho Chi Minh, who was the leader of North Korea during that period of time. I mean, he'd gone to the States. There had been American advisors after the Second World War in that, what was then Indochina, and they, you know, they again, they don't seem to see the nuances that suddenly started to happen, because obviously the People's Republic of China had come onto the scene then, and that was an absolute more terrifying prospect perhaps to the Americans, that what was happening over there.
You know, my grandfather was an anti-communist back in Burma. He didn't want the communists. There was a communist rebellion at the time to succeed. He wanted a liberal democracy, as he understood it, in the country to succeed instead. But he said to the Americans, he said in a speech sometime in the 1960s, he said, America should be on the side of revolutionary change in the ex-colonial world. They shouldn't fear, you know, this country that was born out of revolution shouldn't fear revolution in these countries. And what he meant by that is that, you know, these people want change. They want, you know, they want to become independent, but they also want social change. They want economic progress. They want to catch up with the rich countries. They want all of these things. And America shouldn't be worried about it. It should embrace it and be on the side of it. And it shouldn't worry too much that a few of these people might call themselves communists or something else. I think the more America embraces people's desire for change, the more people are going to stay away from the most radical kind of options and stay away from the kinds of, you know, dictatorial systems, communism, everything else that he himself didn't want to see happen in his own country as well.
As a former sort of school teacher, he must have also learned the value of education, because if you look at one of the things that happened with revolutions, it tends to be you get cadres going in and they subtly suggest or quote unquote brainwash, you know, the young into following that doctrine. Again, Cultural Revolution in China, etc. Year Zero, horrendously in Cambodia. So was that something as well he was passionate about or knew the value of education? Because again, there tends to be that sort of, and I'm changing my words very carefully, but you can say the both superpowers, especially in the Americas, when they have their policy of bringing Vietnamese into special hamlets they've created, you know, they're looking down on them. They're not engaging with them. They're telling them what to do without knowing the culture, the history, the backgrounds.
I mean, his personal values were different. I mean, he was a conservative Buddhist in Burma, so he had sort of stoic values. He believed in Buddhism in very different ways. But he was also, you know, I think he would have considered himself a social democrat or a democratic socialist. He read a lot of Fabian literature back in the 1920s when he was in this little school. His role model was Stafford Cripps, you know, the labor lawyer. So, you know, he was this kid in Burma modeling himself on these labor politicians in the 1920s. So those were his values. He believed in democracy, but he was also in some ways a man of the left at that time. He definitely didn't want these kind of radical solutions like communism. He didn't like that at home at all. But with the Americans, yes, absolutely. I mean, he saw, you know, he engaged with all the top Americans, Lyndon Johnson and all the rest, and he felt they didn't really understand what was happening in a place like Vietnam, that it was a nationalist struggle. People wanted change. And the more the Americans stood against Vietnamese self-determination, independence, interfered from this top-down way that you just mentioned, the more the Vietnamese were going to be pushed into the arms of the Russians, the Chinese, and move in a more and more radical direction. So I think he wanted a peaceful solution. And in the end, whether it was in the Middle East or in Vietnam or elsewhere, he believed that peace was the best way to get to a non-radical outcome and have countries be genuinely independent in the way that they should be.
And it was only just brokering the peace, but it was maintaining the peace. I mean, 1967, the Six Day War, of course, you know, he's involved with that, and he manages to somehow maintain the ceasefire holds. Tell me a little bit about that one.
Well, he was blamed. I mean, if you read a lot of history books, one of the things that people, if anything, remember about him is that he withdrew UN peacekeepers from the Sinai on the eve of the Six-Day War. And that's true. And he may have made a mistake in some of his decisions at that time, but it was a red herring. I mean, there was a couple of thousand men strung out along a, you know, several hundred mile long front. They wouldn't have made any difference. There were 70,000 Egyptian troops right around them. The Israeli army was preparing to invade Egypt as well. So, you know, it didn't really matter. He was scapegoated for war that other people, whether it was the Israelis or the Americans or the Egyptians, wanted in different ways. In the aftermath of the war, he went from someone who was seen as very pro-Israeli in many ways. He was a friend of Israel. He had many, you know, friends, Golda Meir, David Ben-Gurion, all these people were people that he knew, to being someone who was seen as not pro-Israeli enough because he stood against the occupation. He wanted to see an end to that occupation, and he was looking for a peaceful solution. I mean, he negotiated some of these ceasefires with his mediators on the ground. But in 1970, he helped to craft, together with the Nixon administration, actually, a peace plan that almost succeeded, that could have succeeded, which would have seen a withdrawal of Israel from the occupied territories.
When did his tenure finish at the United Nations?
It was at the end of 1971, so it was after a decade. He was the first Secretary General to also last that long in office. Through Vietnam's Six-Day War, but also many wars. He negotiated the 65 India-Pakistan War, and all this way, he was still this school teacher from Burma in a way who was trying to meet all of these challenges one after another.
Presumably, I mean, you do a decade of doing that. I mean, the burnout factor must have come in there, surely. I mean, the impact of, I mean, you can never just sort of, wind down and play around the golf, because you've always got, because you must have been thankful there weren't mobile phones on the planet at that point, because you can never switch off.
Yeah, luckily, it was before mobile, long before mobile phones. Yeah. I mean, he wasn't an old man. He was in his 50s all of this time. But by the end, he collapsed in his office a couple of times. I think he had a lot of stress-related ailments and problems. He only took 10 days off those entire 10 years, except for Sundays. But he did take off in a way. So every, evening he would be home by 8 or 9, and then he would just be with family. He would watch TV. He would, have a curry and watch some sports or watch, late night television. And so he did have a kind of a discipline in that way. But otherwise, he was working relentlessly and traveling around the world constantly over that decade.
As your grandfather, what memories do you have of him, if you have any at all?
Yeah, I mean, it's a hazy memory because I was a little kid. I just remember it. I don't remember him ever in any way kind of bringing, work home. I mean, I always just remember him with us swimming in the pool, watching TV, looking at the garden, looking after the garden, those kinds of things. And so, I mean, he liked to be a family man. I think he just didn't have the time to do that as much as he would have wanted during those years.
Now, people will say to me, why, Charles, why are you so interested in history? It's a bunch of, boring old white men and kings and doing stuff like that. But and people say, oh, history repeats itself. Well, doesn't it actually repeat itself? But there are subtle ripples that come out from a center, if you like. And you're looking at the work of the UN in this period of time. And then, of course, the UN has been front and center over the past couple of weeks with what's happening in the world. When you research something and you write a book like this, Dan, do you look about how the impact the UN had then and what the UN is now, and perhaps not despair, but just sort of shake your head? Because at the moment, UN knocking the UN seems to be the de rigueur, as the saying goes.
No, absolutely. And, when he retired at the end of 71, his retirement party included people like John Lennon, and Joan Baez was a big supporter. Jackie Kennedy helped to fund it. Pete Seeger sang. John Lennon actually sang Imagine for the first time in America at his retirement party at the end of 71. But, if you look back at that time, so many things seem the same. There's a Security Council meeting on the Middle East. There's a war somewhere in Africa that they're desperately trying to deal with. There are all kinds of things that seem to be kind of parallels to what we have now, superpower conflict or possible conflict. But the big difference was that people were hopeful. They were still hopeful that the UN could bring about a global peace. And I think the difference is that they were much closer, or they were still of that generation of people, mainly men, but also women, who twice in their adult lifetime had seen horrible world wars that killed tens of millions of people, with a Great Depression in between. And they felt that something different had to be possible, that they couldn't just go back to the idea of big power conflicts and spheres of influence and military alliances, but that they had to build a different world architecture for peace. And then there was still a commitment to that, even amongst businessmen, politicians, ordinary politicians in the West, as well as in the newly decolonized countries everywhere. And I think we've lost that. We've lost that connection with that earlier horrific experience that I think fueled that enthusiasm for the UN. And I think unless we get that back, it's really hard to see how the system can work.
The book is called Peacemaker, UTHANT, the United Nations and the Untold Story of the 1960s. It's by Thant Mintu. If people want to find you online, I know you're on at least one social media, because I saw you this morning. Where can they find you to converse with you?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter, LinkedIn, and also I have my own website, which is thampianew.com.
The book is called Peacemaker. Thampianew, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks very much.
Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday, good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2 times the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.